You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello, mateys, and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. It be Wednesday, September 19th, Talk Like a Pirate Day, and this be your host, Captain Stephen Novella. Joining me is the scurvy dog, Bob Novella.
Arr, you bootlickers!
The saucy lass, Cara Santa Maria.
There she blows!
Jay Novella!
Call me Captain Orangebeard.
And the scallywag, Evan Bernstein.
Avast, ye mateys.
Or is it ye hearties?
Ye hearties?
Ye hearty mateys.
Did we really just do this? Oh my god.
Yeah. Steve.
What? Avast, ye skeptics, don't get hornswoggled.
Hornswoggled. I like that one. Ooh, this is my favorite. Cleave him to the brisket.
Cleave him to the
Translate, please.
That means to cut him across the chest.
Aye.
Cleave him to the brisket.
Aye, you're going to cleave him to the brisket.
So, if you haven't guessed, September 19th is International Talk Like a Pirate Day. Is this the first time we're recording on International Talk
Like a Pirate Day? It might be. I don't remember.
Maybe.
I don't know. I think we may have done one or two.
Or this is the first time we remembered that we were recording on Talk Like a Pirate
Day. I have collected two incredible pirate jokes that I've probably said on the show before. I'd be very happy to tell you guys them if you want to hear them.
Sure.
Yes, please.
So this pirate walks into a bar with a steering wheel attached to his zipper, and the bartender's like, "Hey, what the hell is that?" And the pirate goes, "Arr, it's driving me nuts."
Classic.
Yeah. Classic J pirate joke.
This one is brilliant. What's a pirate's favorite letter in the alphabet?
R.
They like R, but they love the C.
All right, I got one, and this is from one of my favorite costumes at Dragon Con, and that's saying
oh,
something.
Yes.
But it wasn't just the costume; it was this guy owned that character so well that I was following him around just to laugh and see what he was going to do and say next.
This is the guy in the ship.
Yeah. So imagine a guy in a little ship. With legs that are about 8 feet long. So walking on stilts. Oh, and he was
least,
hilarious. So I was filming him, and he's like, "Oh, you're filming a movie. So you want to hear a joke? Want to hear a pirate joke?" I'm like, "Of course. Hello. Do you know who I am?" Which he didn't. And so he's like, "All right, what's on the bottom of the ocean and twitches?" And I'm like, "What?" It's a nervous wreck.
Hi-oh.
Oh, man. And his delivery, of course, was much better than mine. But this guy was magic. I loved him so much.
Bob, how do pirates know that they're pirates?
I don't know, Jay.
They think, therefore they are.
Oh, no. Nice.
Not good.
Not bad. Not
nice.
Bad.
Not good. Why couldn't the kid get into the pirate movie?
It was rated R. Oh,
a little too obvious.
Why don't pirates go to strip clubs?
They already have all the booty.
Oh, I like that.
Kara, what do you call a pirate with two eyes and two legs?
What?
A rookie.
Oh, I get it. I get it.
All right, let's move on, shall we?
Yes.
I do want to apologize to all of our listeners for this embarrassing display.
Yes. What? It's the best.
We will never do this again, but
until
I am looking
year.
Forward
until
to
until next year.
Well, I'm looking forward to Talk Like a Highlander Day. That is coming up.
Yeah. Is that coming up?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You have to get that out of your system before we visit Scotland, guys, before we go to Edinburgh.
Oh, boy. Yeah, you're right.
Hey, Siri, remind me every year on September 19th that it's Talk Like a Pirate Day. I hate when I forget.
Bob is still mad that he just learned that it was Talk Like a Pirate Day all day.
Every year I forget. Like, what the hell is wrong with me?
How much did the pirate pay for his peg and hook?
How much?
What?
An arm and a leg.
That's good. Thank you. I love it.
All right, Kara.
Yeah.
What be the word today, Lassie?
I don't know how to say this one with an accent. It'd be Bajanim. So I was looking up how to pronounce this word because I naturally want to say Bayesianism, but it seems like at least the American pronunciation is Bayesianism. It's spelled Bassionym. But you will see it spelled different ways depending on the field that uses it. You may see Bayesianism with a Y instead of an I, or you may even see it as Bayesianism. B-A-S-O-N-Y-M. So this was recommended by Josh Aston, who is a biotech patent attorney in Indianapolis. He came across this when he was reading. And interesting word. I have seen it once or twice, but had no idea what it meant, and I have never heard it spoken. But a Bayesianism is the original name given to an organism. But obviously, most things still have their original names, and we don't call them all Bayesianisms, and that's because we only talk about an organism's Bayesianism if it has since been given a new name. Generally, that happens because the original name is no longer considered accurate. You know, at the time that the naturalist or the scientist first named it, they didn't know of any other species or any other things within that genera. And then eventually they realized later that maybe it was misnamed. So inherent in the term Bayesianism is the additional requirement that the new name is based upon the original name. And when I was looking this term up, I found a lot of scientific articles, mostly within botany, where when a species was described, underneath the description it would say Bayesianism, and then it would have another Latin name, and then it would say next to it when that name was given and who that name was given by. So I have one example.
But wait,
yes.
It has to be, the new name has to be based on the original name in order for the original name to be a Bayesianism?
Some of the definitions that I find online say that, some don't.
So Eohippus then wouldn't be a Bayesianism? Pyracotherium?
But it might be because, okay, what's the new name?
Pyracotherium. The problem was not, it was that it was priority. So, you know, the name of a species is based on the name of the first specimen of that species. So it turns out that some errant fossil that was found first and given the highly misleading name Pyracotherium, this is for the first horse, first one in the horse lineage. So that got, Pyracotherium got precedence over Eohippus, even though Eohippus is a much better name.
But now nothing's called Eohippus?
Right.
Yeah, the remaining species are now thought to belong to a different genera called Eohippus, which had previously been synonymized with Pyracotherium. Oh, yeah, that's interesting. What I did see is that in some of the Bayesianisms, what they would do is even though the genus name was changed, they would keep the same species name. And so then it was still considered a Bayesianism because it was still based on the original species name. They would just change the genus.
What about Brontosaurus?
Brontosaurus is such a confusing one, isn't it? So it went back to being Brontosaurus. But again, that would be the genus, right? So if they did have individual species, Brontosaurus is the genus. So Excelsis is the species. It was actually, well, that was the type specimen by Marsh. It was originally called the Brontosaurus. So it was changed, but then it came back. So I guess that would be the Bayesianism. But at the time, let's say when it was actually written as Apatosaurus in different books, you know, because for a long period we thought Brontosaurus was a chimera, like that it was an Apatosaurus with a Camarasaurus skull, right? So let's say somebody had been writing about Apatosaurus, they may have put underneath it Bayesianism Brontosaurus. Mm-hmm. But the species name may have remained the same. It would have been maybe Apatosaurus excelsis. Instead of Brontosaurus excelsis. So I did notice that a lot of times that is how they qualified it, is they would maintain the same species name, even though the genus was changed to something that was a little bit more modern and more accurate. So I have an example here that was listed in a blog online by user Monochromatico, and they said, a short example, Linnaeus classified the tea plant as, is it Thea? T-H-E-A? You think Teus sinensis? But some decades later, Sweet noticed that the genus Thea wasn't really different from the genus Camellia and renamed all the Theas as Camellias. Thea sinensis became Camellia sinensis because he had to keep the specific epithet, the name, the same as the original name or the Bayesianism for that species. So yeah, they maintained the same species name, but they changed the genus name. And the etymology of this was a little bit harder to dig up, but obviously it's based on Latin roots. Onym we see as a suffix on a lot of like pseudonym. That means name, right? And then the Bayesi means base, so original name.
Yeah, it's interesting, the naming conventions in taxonomy and how they arrive. But it's unfortunate that they follow these rules without any like committee overriding the specific rules when necessary, like tweaking them, saying, nope, this name is better. This is what we're going to call it, rather than you just have to follow precedence. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and so what you end up seeing is like a slow and steady shift. But I love it when I see that creative scientists will squeeze in like funny Latin names, or they'll, you know, I don't think that it's kosher to name something after yourself. It happens, but I think a lot of people try not to do it. But they'll name something after a professor or after somebody who influenced them, or maybe they'll name it after like their mother or something like that. So you'll see that quite often.
The host of their favorite podcast or something like that.
Exactly. Hey. Or one of the rogues. That's cool, too.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Kara.
Uh-huh.
Jay, tell me about SpaceX flying to the moon.
Well, around the moon.
Yes.
So in recent news...
there and back again.
Yeah. A Hobbit's holiday to the moon. In recent news, on September 17th, 2018, SpaceX announced that they have accepted to take a private citizen on a 4-day mission, 4 to 5 day, that'll fly around the moon and, of course, come back to the Earth. This mission is planned for early 2023. They're hoping to hit that date. And this is a milestone, guys, on multiple levels. So it'll be the first time that a private citizen or citizens have flown beyond low Earth orbit. It's also the first time a private citizen will go to see the moon. And this is a group of people going this time, you know, a group of just regular people. Now, did you guys know that?
Yes.
No.
Right out of the gate, it's important to note that since the Apollo 17 moon mission back in 72, no one has traveled beyond the Earth's orbit.
Mm-hmm.
That's 1972.
That's insane.
A long time.
That's over a decade longer than I've been around.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So who gets to do this? Who's the guy? This is a Japanese billionaire.
Yeah, so he's not exactly a regular guy.
No, absolutely not.
He's a billionaire.
He's a billionaire.
One of the billionaires, yeah.
He's a Japanese billionaire, Yusaku Mizawa, and he will handpick a group of 6 to 8 artists to go with him. Now, he happens to be the founder of an e-commerce website called ZozoTown, and it's a hugely successful Japanese e-commerce website. And that's where he made all of his money. Now, he said that the moon fueled his imagination and he couldn't pass up the opportunity to go on the mission or flight or whatever we're going to call this, because it's, you know, it's not really a mission, even though I believe SpaceX is using this as a test because they want to start using the aircraft. And it puts a mark on the calendar to hit. Listen to this, guys. He's bringing all of these artists with him because he wants – all of this artwork that'll be created by these artists will, you know, further inspire humanity. And he's going to share this on his website that he created called dearmoon.earth. And I think this is a wonderful idea. You know, these artists are going to be hugely impacted by this trip that they go on, and he just wants them to have the inspiration to make all of this incredible artwork. So I just think it's a really nice way to put a very human touch on, you know, doing something as profound as going to the moon. It's just, you know, it's not just the science and the facts and, you know, being super safe, but there's also this artistic feel to it as well. And I think Elon, you know, I think he's enjoying that idea because he said, you know, Elon was saying that he feels reinvigorated by the purchase of this tremendous cost that Mizawa absorbed to do this. Now, check this out. Mizawa invited Elon to go on the trip with them. And what's funny, you know, it's a good thing Elon didn't knee-jerk turn to him and go, no way, you know. Like,
yeah, right.
Because it's also
crazy.
Yeah, it's a great way to for him to feel secure about going on the trip if the guy, you know, that is running the whole thing goes with it. But, you know, I think it would be really cool if he went on that trip. I'd be really impressed if Elon decided to actually go on one of his ships and do this. That would be awesome. Now, unfortunately, neither of them disclosed what the cost would be. I thought that that was going to be part of the announcement, but it wasn't. Mizawa had already given a significant initial payment to SpaceX, and to make it clear, he's paying for all the people that are going. None of them are paying into any of it. It's all coming out of his pocket. I don't know what the $5 billion price tag was that Elon mentioned. I don't know if he's talking about all the money that he spent on the BFR, which is the... you know what BFR stands for?
Big Falcon Rocket.
Right, or big something rocket.
An alternate option.
I'm thinking that the total cost to develop it was $5 billion. But then he thanked Mizawa, saying that his contribution was a significant amount funding towards the end, meaning, you know, that he paid a lot of money to do this, and it probably was a big chunk of that $5 billion, or a chunk of it, you know. Who knows how much, though.
Well, that makes sense, then, that he would be the guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder if he will, and the artists, will all have to do some preliminary testing.
Oh, they are.
Of some sort.
They're
because they say that people most people will experience space sickness, and mm-hmm. your trip to the moon and back could just be one long, horrible experience if you wind up really suffering those ill effects while in space.
You're totally
right.
Well,
it was even for the Apollo astronauts. Yeah.
Well, we can prepare people better today than we ever could, because we have the Vomit Comet, and we have ways of testing them. But when push comes to shove, they're going to be undergoing about 3 Gs during the takeoff and acceleration. And then once they slowly shift into microgravity, that's when, you're right, Ev, that's when the pukey vomit stuff could start happening. And it's really hard for them to test what it would be like for someone to be weightless. The Vomit Comet can do 20, 30 seconds of weightlessness. But, you know, think about it. They're going to be completely weightless. They're going to be disoriented. And lots of other bad things can happen to them, too. Not just feeling sick when they're up there. They will be exposed to more radiation, without a doubt. But if any type of solar particle event happens, they could get 6 months of radiation in just 2 days. Just in two
Yikes.
Days. And, you know, they're also saying that the mental strain from the flight could be pretty significant, because they're in a much smaller confined space than anybody is used to, and also they have to be with those people. It could take one bad apple to ruin this experience for everyone. One person suffering to such a degree that everyone else could get really upset just being around someone that's super disoriented.
Have you ever had that before? Have any of you? I mean, obviously not in space, but like one time I was on a whale watching boat, and like one person was puking nonstop the whole time, and everybody's crowded around them and trying to make them feel better, and it really kind of like bummed out the trip.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I got,
you know what I mean?
I got sick on a fishing trip.
Steve is
you were that guy.
Yeah. I'm usually the puking guy.
Yeah, he's notoriously susceptible. Like when he puked on the captain's boat's boots or shoes when we were on a cruise when we were little kids. That was fun.
What?
Oh.
That's what my memory is telling me anyway.
That's what I'm told.
Captain Steubing.
Right.
So there is danger here too, guys. Now, just because this could be considered, in a way, a commercial flight, it doesn't mean that it's going to be automatically safe. Elon made a point of saying that it's going to be dangerous. And he said, and I quote, "When you're pushing the frontier, it's not a sure thing." So getting back to the BFR rocket. So we have the rocket and the capsule. And if you haven't seen it, you should definitely take a look at some of the pictures that they have now. Now, this rocket is primarily going to be used to shuttle people from Earth to Mars. That's why Elon is building this rocket.
And the goal is for this rocket.
Did they use
to
the
be
term
used.
Shuttle?
Yeah.
It can hold 100 people.
Yeah. The rocket, when it's outfitted correctly, could hold up to about 100 people. And in this mission, that they're going to be taking up some of that space to bring extra fuel, extra food and water, and some repair supplies just in case, anything goes
just
wrong.
Just extra safe, yeah.
Now, they have some other plans for the BFR as well. They want to do, of course, it'll be the heavy hauler that SpaceX needs to bring things into low Earth orbit, bring up supplies for the International Space Station. It'll also be bringing up, other satellites and things like that. But one cool thing that they said, now this is something that we've been waiting for a long time. I remember hearing about this back in the 80s, is the point-to-point trips. So as an idea, you want to go from New York City to Australia, and you want to do it in an hour. Well, this ship could get you there super fast.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, of course, this is going to be hugely expensive, but there's people out there that can afford these types of trips, and then the cost will come down as technology progresses and it becomes, they upscale it to a certain degree. Steve said that the BFR can carry up to 100 people. And of course, this is, again, like I said, guys, this is a test for what he's got planned for this ship. I mean, the whole thing behind this ship, Kara, was that he wants to bring people, he wants to populate another planet. And Mars is the number one pick at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting, when we posted this on our Facebook page, a lot of comments were like, oh, great, more tourism for billionaires, who cares?
Oh, God.
But that totally misses the point. The whole point about this is that private, as Elon himself said, private customers or any customers for BFR are incredibly helpful in funding development of the rocket. This is what will make it possible and also eventually bring down the price. It's like, yeah, you know, flying across the Atlantic was also for rich people initially first too, or whatever. They're always going to pave the way because they could afford to be early adopters. This is maybe the ultimate early adopter, you know, paying $1 billion plus or whatever he paid for a trip around the moon. But yeah, that's going to be funding it. That's going to be help actually making it possible.
Yeah, I agree with you, Steve. I mean, as much as, you know, it's frustrating to see people with a lot of money spend a lot of money, this is, it's a great way for this person to spend that kind of money.
Yeah.
You know, I think Elon will keep looking, you know, now that one person is going to be scheduled, there's a lot of people with billions of dollars and, you know, they might be willing to part with a big chunk of it to do it, take a trip like this once in a lifetime.
Send them all to the moon.
Yeah. Just,
Jay, did you mention that NASA is also planning on making a similar trip around the moon in 2023 with their Orion capsule and their Space Launch System?
I didn't.
Oh,
I knew that, but I didn't mention it.
They better coordinate that carefully.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
I want them running into each other.
So that'll be interesting. You know, the NASA versus SpaceX. We'll see which mission comes off first. They're both around the same time.
If I were Elon and I went first, my ship went first before NASA, I would launch a fake alien spacecraft to orbit around the moon and see what NASA does. Evan, the ultimate prank.
Well, we're at the, what is this? The dawn of the moon 2.0, as far as humans are concerned, in a way, you know?
Yep, definitely.
Hopefully. All right, thanks, Jay. So, guys, we have some exoplanet news. Kara, I know you're fascinated about this exoplanet update. The first one is about Proxima Centauri B. Are you guys familiar with this?
So sure.
Proxima Centauri is the closest star to our system.
Hence Proxima.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is a red dwarf. It's only a little over 4 light years away. And not too long ago, a exoplanet was discovered in the Goldilocks zone.
Hello.
Around the star. But the problem is, because it's a red dwarf, the Goldilocks zone is very close to the star itself. And so Proxima B is probably so close to the star that it would be tidally locked, like the moon is to Earth, right? Meaning the same face will always face the star.
Mm-hmm.
So one side roasts and the other side totally freezes.
But what about in between?
Mm. Right. So the news is that scientists did a new analysis of Proxima B, trying to model it, like what would it look like?
Okay.
What would the weather be like? So they used basically like a climate modeling software. And they said, all right, we don't know
a lot of variables. How many assumptions did they have to make? Yeah.
Well, yeah, like so they don't know like what the atmosphere is made of, how thick the atmosphere is, you know, is there liquid water on the surface, how much, you know, how deep, et cetera, what is the ocean dynamics. But what they did was they just put in a ton of different variables. They didn't just like make one assumption. They said, okay, let's just run this 1,000 times with 1,000 different sets of parameters and see what the range of possibilities is. And then what they found was that a large number of the scenarios showed that there would likely be a zone on this planet where there would be liquid water.
A belt.
Yeah. Okay. But maybe more than that, Evan. So the interesting thing is, what would the ocean currents be like? Now, on the Earth, we have ocean currents, and that they have a pretty significant effect on the regional climate. New England is a lot warmer than it would otherwise be if it weren't for the Gulf Stream.
Sure.
And the West Coast is actually a lot cooler than it would be if it weren't for Arctic waters coming down along the West Coast. When you include a circulating ocean currents on this planet, actually, that can be significantly efficient in distributing heat from the hot side to the cold side.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, and you could actually get a fairly broad region on the world where you are in the liquid water zone, right? So the habitable zone for life.
How big? How wide?
It depends on the parameters, right? But there would be sort of a permanent tropical water belt you know, that they said. But again, how big depends on the other variables.
Yeah.
With Proxima B, you know, the scientists are going back and forth. It's like, oh, it's a Goldilocks zone. Oh, no, it's hot a little active. Now they're saying, oh, but maybe with, you know, distribution of heat, you could still have this habitable belt around the tropical zone. This is, I think, it's interesting because this is essentially a test case because there's a ton of red dwarfs out there. And red dwarfs are very stable over a long period of time because, you know, the smaller the mass of the star, the longer it lives. So, you know, the red dwarfs can survive for tens of billions, even trillions of years.
Whoa.
Whereas, like, the hotter stars can burn out in 100 million years, can be very, very, very short. And, like, our sun is somewhere in the middle. You know, it's going to survive 6-7 billion years. So the problem is early on in their life, they are very unstable. They fluctuate a lot and send off a lot of coronal mass ejections. And so if you have a planet that's really close,
right,
because the Goldilocks zone is really close, it probably had its atmosphere stripped away from it by the early volatility of the red dwarf. But then they say, okay, well, maybe some planets may start farther out and then work their way into the inner solar system, and they don't get there until after the stars settle down, and then they warm up, and then life happens, you know. So, and the reason why scientists are again so interested in this is because there's so that would dramatically increase the opportunities for life. So even if it happens 1% of the time, you know, that you have a planet that keeps its atmosphere and gets in the Goldilocks zone, that still would dramatically increase the number of potential life-sustaining planets, at least life as we know it, right? This is the closest exoplanet to the Earth, and this is an interesting test case.
Time to send one of our light sails out there, and yeah, in about 20 years, we might know something.
Absolutely. Now, there's another, very quickly, there's another exoplanet news. They found a candidate, an exoplanet candidate,
yeah,
around a star 16 light years from Earth. It's a super Earth. It's about 8 Earth masses, but about twice the diameter. And this is surrounding the star 40 Eridani. Does that have any significance to you guys? Jay, I know you know the answer.
Yeah, that's a sci-fi, definitely a sci-fi star.
Oh, they talk about it in Star Trek?
That is the planet around which Vulcan revolves.
Is it?
Yeah, this is Spock's homeworld. Now, although there were two separate references. First of all, there was no reference in the show Star Trek, in the original series. They never named the star.
Right.
But there were two references in extra content. So Star Trek II by James Blish and Star Trek Maps by Jeff Maynard named the Vulcan's son as 40 Eridani. But there's two other works. The Star Trek Spaceflight Chronology by Stan and Fred Goldstein cites Epsilon Eridani.
That's one that I
instead
was familiar with, yeah.
Yeah, but Roddenberry wanted 40 Eridani. And the reason that is because 40 Eridani is about 4 billion years old, where Epsilon Eridani is only about 1 billion years old. So it's much more likely that 40 Eridani would have life because it's been around longer, especially, you know, a civilization.
More on par with Earth.
Yeah. And also 40 Eridani is a triple star system.
Whoa.
But the exoplanet revolves around the main star, the biggest star of the three. The planet's not a great candidate for life. Some references say that it's just within the Goldilocks zone, but the more primary references say it's probably too close to the star. So it's probably not in the habitable zone. It's like right on the edge, but so they are, I guess there's disagreement about whether or not it's just in or just outside, but I think, unfortunately, it's probably going to be just outside of the zone. But there may be other planets in the same system. This one is not a great candidate for a life-bearing planet, but who knows? We keep looking. We may find others. This star is like an orange star. So it's like not quite as bright as Earth's sun, but it's not a red dwarf either. It's kind of in the middle. So it is a little bit cooler, dimmer, you know, than our sun. And so the habitable zone, again, is closer in, but not as close as a red dwarf. So it's a good star if you're looking for habitable planets. But this one may not be it. So I don't think we should name this planet Vulcan yet until until we have reasonably sure that we have found any planets in the inner system that might be suitable for life.
There was once suspected to be a Vulcan planet going around our star.
Yeah, that was the Mercury problem. Yeah. Very briefly, yeah, until you know, Einstein figured out general relativity.
No more Vulcan.
All right. We're going to come back down to Earth now after a couple of spacey news items. Evan, I got stung by a wasp not too long ago. Probably not an unlikely experience for many people. Most people don't really like wasps.
No, they don't. And did you know the history of wasps is fascinating? So it all began when the Anglos met the Saxons, and they coupled up and procreated and then became Protestants. And they moved into their New England mansions. Wrong wasp. Insects known as wasps, like the one that stung you, Steve, right?
Yeah.
Yes, we are familiar with that. And we've all had probably an experience at some point in our life, an encounter with a wasp. And I doubt anyone enjoyed it. Right. They get a bad rap. Let's put it that way. The wasp is part of the wasp is part of the order Hymenoptera. The suborder is Apocrita, which they share with ants and bees. Wasps, mm-hmm. however, distinguish themselves in the suborder by various physical and behavioral characteristics. Note their smooth and slender body and legs with relatively few hairs, which complements their narrow waistlines. The waistline is also known as its petiole, by the way. But watch out, these are predators, and some of them are even parasitic, right, Bob?
Yeah, babe.
And, like Steve referred to, they all have stingers. That is the dangerous end of the critter.
I think they're pretty, though.
Oh, they're pretty.
Are they smooth or barbed stingers?
They are smooth. They're told they're easy to remove, not the barbed type.
Well, then they don't really get stuck in you, right? If they're smooth, then they can just keep stinging and stinging and stinging. They don't disembowel themselves.
That's right. They won't die as a result of that initial sting. You know, we've talked on the Skeptic's Guide before that nature is trying to kill you. Yeah. And I think stinging insects is part of that broad statement. But here's the news item for the week. A new study has come forth concerning these little flying demons, and it is forcing me to rethink my attitude towards their destruction. The scientists at the University College London, the UCL, they are informing us and reminding others who already know this that wasps are just as important to the environment and to our economy as perhaps bees. And what the scientists have done is essentially expose our anti-wasp biases.
Mm-hmm.
The study is about perception. How do people perceive wasps versus bees? Bees, you know, they stink too, sure, but they make delicious honey and they help flowers spread through pollination. They seem to be less...
Sweetness and light is what
they are. Yeah, they're less aggressive than wasps generally, at least that's the perception.
What about those killer bees?
Well, you know, they've been breeding with some nasty ones, and, you know, they are kind of spreading around a bit. But the colonies are in danger. We've talked about that before on the show. We're losing bee colonies. That's not a good thing. So that's my perception of bees, you know, and I think a lot of people probably share those main characteristics. Now, the study was published in Ecological Entomology. And it's a kind of a small study. 748 members of the public from 46 countries were surveyed. 70% of the respondents happened to be from Britain. So this is a bit of a British-heavy study. But anyways, they judged their perceptions of insects, including bees and wasps. Respondents revealed that wasps are indeed universally disliked by the public. And this is most likely due to a low-level interest in nature and a lack of knowledge about the benefits wasps can bring to the planet's health and function.
Is that really what they think? It's because they don't know about nature? Not because they're scared they're going to get stung?
Based on their surveys that they did and the results, the data they pulled in from these 748 people. That is what they said. But they also stated, that there might even be a research bias against wasps. Wasps are an unpopular choice of insect for researchers to study, which they say can compound the negative image that wasps have. And we're not doing enough on the other side to communicate and comprehend the positive role that they play in the ecosystem. So here's the study author, Dr. Sirian Sumner. He says, "It's clear we have a very different emotional connection to wasps than to bees. We have lived in harmony with bees for a very long time, domesticating some species, but human-wasp interactions are often unpleasant as they ruin picnics and they nest in our homes. Despite this, we need to actively overhaul the negative image of wasps to protect the ecological benefits that they bring to our planet, and they are facing a similar decline to bees, and that is something the world can't afford. So that's something I did not know, is that wasp populations are also being threatened. Now, in regards to scientific research concerning wasps, the scientists discovered this bias by quantifying the number of scientific research papers and conference presentations for bees and wasps over the last 37 years and 16 years, respectively. So they did two sets. They looked at 37 years of data and 16 years as well. They sampled 908 papers. Only 2.4% of the papers since 1980 involved wasps, 97.6% of the papers involved bees. That is a bee bias, as they say. And let's see, from the last 20 years, 81.3% were on bees and the rest were on wasps. So, but what are the wasps' role in the ecosystem? Well, I think there are three main things.
They kill shit.
They do kill shit. Yes, they are regulators. Good at limiting the harm done by crop pests and insects that can carry human diseases. So that is one of them. Second, they are pollinators, like bees. They fly around and they help plants and flowers bloom. And thank goodness for that. We need more of that. And then the third one, this one I learned today. Some wasps carry yeast cells in their guttywuts.
Their guttywuts?
What the hell? In their cells?
Yeast cells. Researchers not too long ago figured out that some wasps and hornets feed on late season grapes, which are rich in wild yeast. Then the yeast survives the winter in the stomachs of the hibernating queen wasps and then is passed on to their offspring when the mother wasps regurgitate food for their young. The new generation of wasps carries the yeast back to the next season's grapes. They carry yeast. How cool is that? So there are reasons, and wasps are not just annoying and dangerous, they actually help contribute to a healthy ecosystem.
Yeah. To be clear, they are annoying and dangerous, but they also are useful to the ecosystem.
Right.
No, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think, like, my daughters always freak out when they see spiders.
Oh, I love spiders.
I don't have that fear of spiders.
Just leave it alone. It's going to eat a lot of bugs.
Yeah.
Definitely.
They don't eat little girls. Although, you know, they may crawl in your mouth, but don't worry about that.
Yeah, it's fine.
Or nest or lay eggs in your ear. But then,
yeah, it's fine. That. Your body will just push that stuff back out.
So,
spiders are fine.
Spiders are fine. And, you know, I guess wasps, I have to think twice about, you know, just.
The thing about wasps is most of the time, if you leave them alone, they'll leave you alone.
That's right.
You just got to give them a
wide berth,
personal space.
Yellow jackets and hornets. That's what most people experience, those who have bad experiences with these wasps. But they represent 1% of stinging wasps.
That's it?
There are 67... Yeah, that's it. There are 67 species of social wasps. The vast majority of wasps, in excess of 75,000 species, are solitary.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Yep, that's the buzz.
Nice, dude.
One more astronomy item, Bob. This one is about brown dwarfs.
Yeah, the dividing line between a star and a brown dwarf star is getting a little clearer thanks to work by Carnegie scientists. You can find this study published by the Astrophysical Journal by Carnegie's Sergei Dietrich and his colleagues like Alicia Weinberger and Maggie Thompson and some other guys. So I thought this would be a fun follow-up, especially because of our recent moon planet talk. That was a lot of fun. But this one's a little different. The main difference here, though, is that it's not as much of a judgment call. You know, the moon and planet one, there's a lot of subjectivity in there. But for this, you know, star, not a star, it's a little bit, a lot of bit easier. Basically, if a certain mass of gas and dust collapses and sustainably fuses hydrogen, it's a star. If not, then it's not a star. It's not a planet either. It's a substellar object. It's a protostar. It's a failed star, or better known as a brown dwarf, which is actually probably magenta to the human eye, by the way.
Huh.
And there's also some fusion going on. It's not completely bereft of nuclear fusion. It's mostly deuterium, which is a rare isotope of hydrogen, but all real stars, ask any of them, fuse hydrogen for millions upon millions of years, and brown dwarfs do not. So, as you might imagine, though, things get a bit fuzzy as you approach the heaviest brown dwarfs and the lightest stars. When they start coming closer and closer together, then things aren't as neat. The latest theoretical models predict that the boundary separating stars from brown dwarfs occurs in objects that are between, say, say 70 times the mass of Jupiter, around 70. You'll see some variation around there, but 70 is fairly common, sometimes a little bit higher. So that's about 7% of the sun's mass. So if you're a ball of gas of hydrogen and you're about 7% the sun's mass, chances are you will start fusing and become a real star. Otherwise, a little below that and you're Pinocchio and you're just made of wood. Not much else is going on there. Just because the model's good model based on math and observation and things that we know reliably, that doesn't mean that we could say, yes, 70 Jupiter masses is the definite cutoff. So there's some wiggle room in there. So what these researchers were doing were studying two brown dwarfs called Epsilon Indi B and Epsilon Indi C. And I just love those. Those names are just so beautiful. Epsilon Indi. Both of these are too dim to be stars. There's really no question about it. These things are very, very dim. They're not very far away. And that's why we can actually see them. But they're very dim. So they're obviously not shining and are much at all. So they're brown dwarfs. You could be pretty sure of that. But they did do some new, very hyper accurate measurements. And they showed them to be substantially heavier, more massive than they had anticipated. One of them was shown to be 75 Jupiter masses. 75, that's well over 70, which the models say should be in the realm of a star, a real star. The other one was about 70 Jupiter masses, and by some estimates, that should be a star as well. So what's going on? So Dietrich said, taken together, our results mean that the existing models need to be revised. We show that the heaviest brown dwarfs and the lightest stars may only have slight differences in mass, but despite this, they are destined for different lives, one racing to dim and cool, the other shining for billions of years. And it's kind of fun to think that there's some brown dwarfs out there that are just right on the edge, right? They're just so close. The tiniest extra mass could push them over the edge and burst into nuclear flame. Imagine diverting. It makes me think, what could we do if we could actually get to one of those brown dwarfs? And we know that it's just like so close. If we could like divert some asteroids into it, and could we turn it from a brown dwarf into a star, into a real star? And also another thing occurred to me. Lots of things occur to me sometimes. And so imagine if you had a brown dwarf that was on the edge of becoming a star, and you held onto it, until the universe, until entropy starts really creeping up and you really need some extra fuel, then you could kind of push it over the edge and turn it into a star, and then use that released energy to fuel your civilization. Now, do you know how long? I think these brown dwarfs, since they're not really burning, they're not fusing hydrogen, they last an amazingly long time. Like, guess how long? Like maybe 10 trillion years. So that's a trillion. Really, so you can hang on to it for quite a while and then, maybe turn it into a star. But that's really long-term planning. And I digress again. That would be the name of a good like segment maybe. But I digress.
And just
talk about tangents and stuff. So why is this important? Well, I mean, if we have a better definition of what a star is precisely and what a brown dwarf is precisely, it could actually help us determine how many of these things there are. I mean, there's lots of brown dwarfs in our galaxy. Some estimates put it at 100 billion. I mean, but we're not sure. If we had a better idea of, how many there are, then we could answer some questions. Like, for example, if there's so many of them, they could be a significant fraction of the missing mass in the universe, that type of stuff. It might make a difference one way or the other. Maybe not, but it might. Also, the more we know about these brown dwarfs and which ones are stars and which ones are brown dwarfs, it could help us in terms of like if you're looking at the proportion of stars to brown dwarfs, it could help us better understand, the overall habitability of our galaxy, for example, because if there's more brown dwarfs, then there's less stars and who knows. So just a fun, interesting study that I came across that had a some good tangents to it. So I thought it'd be a fun discussion. So
it is interesting, you know, where that dividing line is. But here, like, the definition is not the issue. It's just where the mass cutoff is.
Right.
And I wonder, is it always the same exact mass, or is it, or does the composition matter? Like, if there's more helium, might the mass need to be higher?
Well, yeah, they're, and also the evolution of these critters can vary. You know, they're, you know, what it took to get them to where they, what we call a brown dwarf, can vary. So maybe some people are saying maybe we should define them, you know, in terms of what their evolution was rather than just their mass or whatever. But they're complicated beasts. As I was doing research, I was like, damn, there's a lot I forgot about brown dwarfs, and really. Obviously my talk was fairly superficial. And if you want to learn more, definitely, you know, Google's out there, and you could really learn an amazing amount about just these protostar substellar brown dwarfs.
All right. Thanks, Bob. So Kara, just last week we were talking about the Myers-Briggs, and right after our show came out, there was a study about personality types. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's a little bit complicated, the methodology that was used in this study. Anybody who has spent a little bit of time doing psychometrics or doing statistical analysis, like multivariate statistical analysis, might kind of understand what was happening. But the cool thing is that this was done by, like, physicists. There's only one psychologist on the team, which we'll see. The interpretation is up to interpretation. But basically, these researchers decided that they wanted to do the biggest study known to date on what they consider personality type. And they use two different terms throughout their publication that I think we need to make sure that we understand at the top. Personality types versus personality traits. So personality types are what the Myers-Briggs claims to give you. Like, I am an INTJ. That's my personality type. And that is incredibly disavowed, I suppose, by many psychologists. We talked about it last week. Revisit last week's conversation if you want to hear some of the major concerns with the Myers-Briggs. A lot of psychologists actually say that there are is no such thing as a personality type in its truest form. There are personality disorders, and there are different traits that individuals might have that in a constellation kind of way would lead to their personality. But to type people is maybe not that reasonable. But these researchers said, I shall try. So what they did is they looked at a bunch of collected data, and they decided that they wanted to do some exploratory factor analysis within this data. At least that's where they started. 1.5 million participants, but it came from four different data sets, so each of them were between 100,000 and 500,000. And they were different types of tests that had collected all of this data, that had asked a lot of very specific types of questions. It's unimportant. I think it's things like, you know, I like to be around a lot of people, or I find myself uncomfortable in large groups, things like that. And they went through all the data and they used an analytic technique called factor analysis. And I don't really think we have time to dive too deep into factor analysis, but basically what it does is that you look through a bunch of data, and what you find is that people who tend to respond one way on certain items will also tend to respond a similar way on different items. And people who tend to respond a different way on those items will tend to respond a different way on other items. And eventually there are these patterns that start to emerge within the way people answer questions. And you start to see these, like, clusters or these factors come to the surface. Analytically, though, exploratory factor analysis is very different from confirmatory factor analysis, in that when you do exploratory factor analysis, you're going in blind. So you're just looking at data and you're saying, I wonder how it's going to clump. And then when it clumps, you as a human being have to say, what does that clump mean? What shall I call that clump? And what they did when they first dove into this data is that they found something like 11 or 13 clumps. And when they started to dig through the factors that they were pulling out, they weren't meaningful. They weren't able to put words to them. They weren't able to say, this is a true personality factor that we found. And so they decided, okay, instead, maybe we'll do something that's a little closer to a confirmatory factor analysis. We'll feed in the big five. Do you guys remember talking about the big five last week when we were talking about Myers-Briggs?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that was ocean. That's the way I always remember. Openness to new experiences, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. The big five are measurements of personality traits, not types. So the idea is that on any of those scales, you'll either fall on one end, on the other end, or somewhere in the middle. I tend to be, you know, more introverted, but also more open to new experiences. I'm about moderate on neuroticism. I'm very high on conscientiousness, and I'm like medium on agreeableness, right? So that doesn't mean I have a personality type. It just means I know where I land on these different traits. So what they said is, okay, let's feed some of this data that we know about the big five into our model. And we'll be a little bit more selective when we look at our clusters, and we'll see what comes out of the model. The unique thing here is I mentioned before these were physicists, right? So they were actually using machine learning algorithms to do this modeling. And that's kind of a twist. That's not something we do very often when we do factor analysis. We use really sophisticated statistical software. You don't do this kind of stuff by hand, but we don't usually have machine learning as a part of the conversation. And what they ended up doing as they drove through is that they found four factors, and they were salient. They really stuck out of the data. And after multiple people looked at it, they agreed with them. Even the psychologist on the team who doesn't believe in personality traits. And so the interesting thing is, I still don't know if you could call these traits, but they did find, you know, whatever the word you want to use, types, distinct personality, blahs. And those four that they found are these. This is what they've named them. Because remember, this is a human endeavor. They found patterns in the data, but they still had to name them. One of them they're calling role model. So people tend to be more role model-esque. One of them they're calling self-centered, which a lot of the reporting in popular science articles is, they're just calling that jerks. Like, there just tends to be kind of a jerk trait that people are finding. The third one that they found is reserved. And so you could see how that could be kind of similar to introversion or extroversion, which does tend to be the most sort of statistically or maybe methodological, that's the wrong word. It's like the most valid of the big five that we've been able to see. And then the last one, guess what they're calling it? Anyone?
No.
The average one?
Average.
Average. Oh, right. That's where most people fit into.
Yeah. And that's the thing that's annoying. It's like, even in the reporting of this, a lot of people are saying, oh, it's very uninspiring. It's like, no, it's not that it's uninspiring. It's that it was the remainder. It was the exclusion, you know, it was where most people fall. And so.
But Kara, to be clear though, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying, not everybody fell into one of these four groups.
No, people
were spread out. Yeah, they were spread out all over the place. These were just areas of relative abundance, and there were other areas of relative voids, but not everyone fits into one of these four types.
No, you've got to think about factor analysis like it's this hierarchical method. So you take tons of data and then you look for trends in the data and you pull them out. And then you take what's left over and you look for the next biggest trend in the data and you pull it out. And then you look at what's left over. So there's always stuff left over. It's just that these four were the biggest clusters they could find, but everybody didn't cluster into them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And there was a lot of potential clusters that turned out to be spurious.
Yeah, 11 to 13 at the top that they couldn't put a name to. They didn't seem to be right. And so one of the researchers actually used a really beautiful analogy, which I think is a good way to explain it. He said, listen, think about all of the people that live in America. Most people that live in America live in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Houston. Or I'm sorry, I shouldn't put it that way. A lot of people, more people live in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Houston than any other city in America, right? But most of the people in America don't live in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Houston. It's just those are the biggest clusters you could pull out of the data. But they don't account for everybody in the country. Like, okay, if somebody lives in Newark, you could put them in the New York cluster or in the New York factor. But if someone lives in Pittsburgh, I don't know. Are they New York or are they Chicago? Well, I don't know. Yeah. It's pretty hard to label them. And so I think that's a good way to think about this kind of data analysis if you've never done it before, because it can be sort of complicated. It's like multidimensional space. There are these weighted things that they pulled out of the data. that is a really important part that you pointed out, Steve. Not everybody fits these things, but what they are finding is that these things tend to be the strongest things out there. And it's the biggest analysis of its type. The data appear to be quite rigorous, but the interpretation of the data, which is often the part that we forget about when we're reading science reporting, there's a lot to be said about it. And even the researchers are like trying not to overly interpret this data. It's a good starting point. You know, maybe these should be new launch pads for trying to understand personality. Because if we look back, and I don't remember, Jay, if this is something that you mentioned last week when you talked about the Myers-Briggs, but the Myers-Briggs is not empirically founded. There's been a lot of research after the Myers-Briggs was developed to try to validate it, which didn't often work, or to try to find reliability measures within it, which are very low. But it's a theoretically founded test, meaning nobody looked at data and said, we're going to build a personality type indicator based on that. It's based on Jungian archetypes.
Yeah.
Basically, Jung was like, I see that there are many types of people in the world. And then a bunch of his followers were like, Jung was brilliant.
Yeah.
let's make a test around this. But Ocean, the Big Five, is actually based on data. It's based on collecting a lot of personality information and collecting a lot of answers to kind of arbitrary questions and then saying, people tend to sort of be either this or that or somewhere in between. They tend to sort of have this trait or that trait or somewhere in between. So those traits are really well established in the literature. It's what a lot of social psychologists use when they talk about personality, and clinical psychologists, by the way, and vocational psychology, occupational psychologists as well. So this is an interesting launchpad, I think. I am definitely not holding my breath that this is going to pan out to be the end-all be-all of personality. I also think that maybe it's a valid argument that many people make that you can't, that there are no personality types, these enduring types that we can lump everybody into. Instead, maybe we should only be looking at traits that certain people tend to have. But this research does seem to show that among 1.5 million people, some of those people, not all of those people, but some of those people tended to clump into certain factors. And those four factors tended to be very salient amongst the background of the data.
I still don't buy it.
I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I definitely think, like, what is this thing about, like, role model? What is a role model vibe? Like, that certain people are more leaders than follow, or like that certain people are more conscientious. Maybe it just aligns with conscientiousness, because they did find that that one tends to be more female and it tends to skew older. Self-centered tends to skew more male and it tends to skew more teenage. Well, that's not an enduring personality trait then, is it?
So, yeah, I have a big problem with the personality types, and not necessarily even that they don't exist. It's just that I think that they tell us a lot less about somebody than is generally presented, or the public tends to think. So even from this study, so I pointed that out about the distribution, because, again, this is like, you had to do sophisticated statistical analysis to see these statistical clumps. And but it is, there is much more chaos than there is order in this distribution of these personality traits. I think personality traits are measuring something real about people.
Ocean.
Yeah, Ocean. But even there, I'm not sure, other than the introvert extrovert, I don't know that we've gotten down to bedrock, down to something fundamental. Like, there's a circuit in the brain that does that. And the other thing is, I think that it leaves so much out. I know that, you know, personality researchers say the Big Five isn't the all of personality. It's just the Big Five, but there's a lot of subtypes underneath that, and there's a lot more that's not necessarily captured by that. But
yeah, it's the best empirical test that we have. Basically.
But personality itself, like, whatever that is, I mean, I think what's intelligence? It's what we measure on IQ tests. Like, what's personality? It's what we measure on personality inventories. And, you know, operationally, that's basically what it is. But think about this, though. The thing is, like, whenever I think about any of these tests or any way of trying to characterize personality traits, or, you know, even more so personality types, then think of all the people you know and try to really think about them objectively. How much does any of this really tell you about anybody. Not damn much. It really mm-hmm. doesn't. Although people look for themselves in the description. But if you really think about it, like how I understand people that I know very well, this doesn't even touch it. There's so many other layers going on here. The skills that people have, the life experiences, the culture, the family dynamic, all of those things. There's so many more important things about how people think, behave, act. You know, that really goes into what we colloquial think of as their personality. That these, even these traits, for most people are average and they just don't mean that much. Again, the more extreme a trait is, the more it's going to tend to dominate, you know, the other aspects of your behavior. But for most people, it's just not that big a deal.
Yeah. It's really telling, first of all, that normal or average was the fourth cluster yeah. that they pulled out, or the fourth factor. Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, Steve, you're absolutely right. And you're speaking my language too. If you were a shrink, you would be an existential shrink. You know, the viewpoint there.
My wife is a counselor. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to her about this today, and she's like, we do not even use this at all in counseling.
No, yeah.
Like you are trying to understand how somebody is working, how they're operating to right at a deep level so that you could do therapy on them. And at that level, this information is just, they don't even do it. It's not useful.
No, this is almost never used within a therapeutic context. The main thing is that like, I tend to orient more existentially. Their view is that you look at the whole person, that they almost don't even diagnose except under extreme circumstances. The place where personality bumps up against the line and actually becomes clinically relevant or therapeutically relevant is when we go into abnormal territory.
Yes. Personality disorders.
Personality
Absolutely.
Disorders. Exactly. But the Big Five doesn't even touch those.
Yeah. But I do think that that's probably where this research is going to go is mm-hmm. I think the most utility will be informing personality disorders. And I also think it's going to get more useful when we start to do the neuroanatomical correlates. When we say, here's your empathy circuit, you know, then you're talking about something that's actually happening in the brain.
Yeah. The problem is that for a lot of these constructs, I think that we're never going to be able to approach Maybe. Them from a neuro perspective because they're so socially derived that Right. I think that if we look at the brain of two people, you know, maybe extroversion, introversion, maybe some levels of neuroticism, fastidiousness, some amounts of conscientiousness. But I do think that when you're looking at like leadership qualities, for example, and you pick one arbitrary construct like ability to command a room, you're never going to find that in the brain.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
you're never going to be able to say that person who commands a room when I look at their brain versus their brain. It's sorry. Like I just don't think that we're going to be able to slice and dice that narrowly.
Not in the foreseeable future anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a benefit to coming up with these labels and categories?
Well, there's a massive, let's say, economic benefit to people who make a living doing this. Whether or not we want to call those people hucksters, I mean, that may be going a little far, but I'll tell you, most professional psychologists don't use any of this stuff except to do research. They don't use it in a clinical setting.
Jay, it's useful from a research perspective to try to mm-hmm. deepen our understanding, but I think we're a few layers away from applicability, which doesn't mean it's not real, doesn't mean they're not making progress. It means it's just too narrow a view of people that it's for most people, it's clinically relevant. Again, unless you have a personality disorder mm-hmm. where one trait becomes a disorder, then we need to know about that.
And the funny thing is those traits aren't even listed in any of these measures. The traits that are disorder generally in diagnosable personality disorders are different traits than even the ones we're trying to look at
right,
here.
Right. But again, that's why I feel like we haven't dug down to fundamental phenomenon yet.
Yeah.
Phenomena. I think we're
phenomena.
Still.
Phenomena. 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 Phenomena.
But yeah, but any kind of like, here's a personality test that will tell you what your type is. That's mm-hmm. all bullshit, in yep. my opinion.
Yeah, that's all Cosmo Magazine. Yeah, astrology. It's like people do it for fun. It's parlor tricks. It's games. The unfortunate thing is there are people that will go into workplaces and tout themselves as experimentalists or theoreticians or even clinicians, and they might even have PhDs, and they'll make bank selling these
yeah, I know.
Workplace. It's a bummer. Like it's another chapter we should have put in the book.
Yeah, it's, well – Part two, right?
Yeah.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time?
Noise.
What?
Oh, my God.
Noise and Gligan.
All right. Yeah, so, guys, last week.
Yeah?
Last week, I played this noisy. What is that?
Oh, that's definitely Crispin Glover. I'm sorry. That is
it, it makes me so uncomfortable.
It does sound like a computer trying to mimic human speech or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of guesses. A lot of people got this one right, by the way, which I thought was a lot of fun. So here's a guess. This one is from Joel Glenister, and he said, "Hi, Jay and the gang. The answer for this week's Who's That Noisy was so easy and obvious. It's the sound of Steve's exhausted voice after recording the SGU audiobook." Another person named Justice Smith. "To me, this week's noisy sounds like a machine learning algorithm producing speech-like sounds."
Yeah, that's what Steve said.
Yep.
Not right?
Not right.
Huh.
Hmm.
And now we got one that's a little bit closer to reality here. We got Julie Brandon, who said, "Hi, folks. Pretty sure I recognize this one. It's a talking crow." It's not a talking crow.
But it's closer to reality?
Yes.
Is this another sea mammal?
No.
It's a bird.
Håkan Bogan wrote, and he's the winner, by the way, "The sounds are generated from Mr. Max the cockatoo, and he doesn't want to go to the vet." And you know what?
Oh, my God.
He's correct. Now, I'll rewind the clip a little bit, and you can hear the lead up to it. Now, just pay close attention to how similar the bird sounds like the guy that owns the bird. And his name is Max, by the way.
"I'm right here. I don't think I need your big bird lips screaming in my ears.
No, you know what, sir?
I do not think I need
it. No, you look like
not at all.
I'm on your side. You're talking about
He's mimicking that guy.
Oh, my God. That guy has a crazy weird voice.
Yeah.
I love it.
And
that's Evan, where the Crispin Glover comes
Evan,
in.
Evan, so weird. That's that guy sounds like Crispin Glover to me.
Yeah.
And you said that last week. I don't think it got into the show last week, but you did kind of say that.
No, he said it again this week.
Yeah, well, okay.
Yeah, but
You did say it. I remembered somebody saying, I figured it was you.
Yes,
it was. And I was like, man, the guy that, the owner of that bird does sound like Crispin Glover. That is so weird. So you nailed it.
I agree. Yes. Thank you. I get the consolation prize this week.
So Håkan, good job. Håkan Bogan. That's a cool name.
That is a cool
Håkan
name.
Håkan Bogan.
I have a new noisy for this week, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
But before I play that noisy, I would like to make a very brief announcement. We are on the SGU Patreon.
Hmm.
We are 300. We need 398 300.
That's so close.
I know. We are so close, guys. 398 people to become members. We can do this. Guys, if you love the SGU, you've been listening to us for years, please become a member. Help us grow to the next level so we can take a bigger piece out of all the pseudoscience that's out there. And I am the key to this. I am the key, Bob.
You're the key master?
I am the key master. You can go to patreon.com/skepticsguide. Check out our the video that Steve and I made that explains what's going on here. And here is this week's new noisy.
Okay, that is the suicide booth on Futurama.
No, it sounded like the $6 million man to me a little bit.
Yeah,
a little bit. Well, not to me.
Yeah, Evan disagrees, apparently.
No. I was like, whatever. That noisy was sent in by Zach Pertelli. Thank you, Zach. Let's see if anyone can figure this one out. If you have any ideas or if you heard any cool noisies this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which ones are really real and which one is completely fake.
Hmm.
All right. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
For this week? Just three regular news items this week. And away we go.
Here we go.
Item number one. A new study finds that it is more emotionally rewarding to be flattering rather than honest when giving critical feedback. Item number two. Japanese scientists report the strongest controlled magnetic field ever recorded at 1,200 Tesla. And item number three. Researchers find that the Amazon River experiences severe flooding five times more often in the last two decades than in the early 20th century. Jay, go first.
All right, this first one. A new study, Steve, finds that it's more emotionally rewarding to be flattering rather than honest when giving critical feedback. Well, of course. Of course. There's no way to even slice through that. Yes. The next one, Japanese scientists report the strongest controlled magnetic field ever recorded at 1,200 Tesla. Whoa. I was reading about magnetic fields not too long ago because of the fusion reactors. If I'm remembering correctly, that is very powerful. I wonder how much energy it would take to create a magnetic field that powerful. And this last one here, researchers find that the Amazon River experiences severe flooding five times more often in the last two decades than in the early 20th century. Yikes, the Amazon River. That means that the rainfall has got to be going crazy. And that's bad. It's not good for rivers to frequently to flood. That is not good. A lot of people live right along that river, too. So if this is true, that is really, really bad. Wow, this is hard, Steve. I mean, now I'm second-guessing even that first one about it being more emotionally rewarding to flatter people than to give them honesty when giving critical feedback. I mean, I can understand, and I know with me that I really like the honest feedback, but sometimes it could be a little hard to hear it. You know, and you'd think that if somebody is giving flattering feedback, that the emotionally rewarding part of it would come from the flattery. So it seems obvious to me that one is the way that it is, but I'm not sure. I don't know, Steve, would you want to give any clarity on what a Tesla is?
It's really, really strong. So like MRI scans, those are usually like three Tesla magnets.
All right. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to say that one is science as well. And I'm going to say that this first one is the fake, the one about the flattering versus honest. Even though I came out swinging when I first thought about it, now that my second pass, I'm going to think it's fake.
Okay. Bob?
The flattering one makes sense. It just makes sense that it's more rewarding to flatter than to be brutally honest. And you do say critical feedback. So maybe that's just too obvious. The third one, the Amazon River. Yeah, global climate change and all makes a lot of sense. So there's something rubbing me wrong with the second one here about the magnetic field. Yeah, I kind of have lost track of the magnitude of Teslas in terms of what's a lot and what isn't. So you're saying that's a lot. And I believe you. I mean, I've heard of, laboratories creating small magnetic fields that, even though they're controlled, I mean, they're not something that's, it's going to come out of a laboratory anytime soon. I think they've gone higher than that, but it's just a kind of a fuzzy memory. But still, I will say that Tesla is fiction.
And Kara?
All right. So yeah. I visited the National High, what's it called? High magnetic field.
Hi, Hyman and the lady.
Oh, wow. You know the one in Florida? The National High? Yeah, yeah. I visited there, and I'm pretty sure their biggest magnet was like 100 Tesla. Unless it was 1,000, but I thought it was like 100 Tesla, and it was like crazy. They were like, you can't even be in the building when we turn it on. And I was like, oh, God. This seems crazy to me. But at the same time, the first one really speaks to me because one time – I was dating a boy. Yeah. I wasn't even dating him. He was just a friend of mine. But we got in a big fight at this cemetery movie we were watching. That's a thing in LA, if you don't know. They like play movies on the side of a mausoleum.
Cool.
Yeah. And because we got in a fight between, like, is it better to be nice or honest? And I was like, always honest. And he was like, F you, you're not nice enough. And so I remember it was a thing. And you know, when people are fighting like that and they start polling all their friends and they're like, I don't want to get in the middle of this. And I don't know. I don't know if I was more correct or if he was more correct, but more emotionally rewarding. You always word these trickily. more emotionally rewarding. So it doesn't mean that they felt better necessarily. Or, I mean, it doesn't mean that they felt like big-headed afterward. It just means that they felt like they gained something. They found more meaning in it. And then this next one, controlled magnetic field. Is that word controlled operative? I don't know. Because what if they were able to just like produce it really quickly and then it was fleeting or something like that? I agree with both of the guys about the Amazon River. I think that, you know, we know that climate change does weird stuff. It's not just drying the world out. It's, you know, causing more rainfall in certain areas. So I would not be surprised if there was some severe weather going on there. I think I'm going to have to go with Jay on this one and say that, I don't know, there's something about the emotionally rewarding one. Like, emotionally rewarding to me doesn't necessarily mean that people felt better about themselves. It just means that they got something positive out of it. So I'm going to say they wanted critical feedback, not flattery. So that one's the fiction.
And Evan.
Amazon River. I agree with everyone. I think it's a climate change issue, a bad one. It leaves the magnets versus the honesty and critical feedback. So with the magnets, yeah, I think the word controlled in there, Kara, I was going to mention that as well. That does seem to be a key word here, although I don't know. I mean, what would an uncontrolled magnetic field of higher than 1,200 Tesla be? Yeah, I think I'll go with Jay and Kara on this. There's something else going on with the receiving of critical feedback people were responding to. Something else is happening. So I think that one's the fiction.
All right. So Bob's all by himself this week.
Oh,
but
man.
You all agree. Right.
Yes, I am. Uh-huh.
You all agree on the big obvious one. Researchers find that the Amazon River experiences severe flooding 5 times more often in the last 2 decades than the early 20th century.
Steve's laughing. This is
you. I know.
Very science. Rewarding. Very emotionally rewarding. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science. Don't worry.
Yes.
This one is science.
Yes. Oh, thank goodness for the severe flooding. I'm so happy.
Oh, that's true. Never mind.
They checked records going back the last 120 years, back to the early 20th century of the Amazon River, and they found that severe flooding, which is levels exceeding 29 meters, was happening roughly once every 20 years in the early 20th century. And now it's happening once every 4 years on average.
Ooh,
so that's 5 times as frequent.
It's terrible.
For between 2009 and 2015. So, yeah, so, you know, this is predicted by global warming because, and we saw this with the recent hurricanes we've had in the U.S. as well. Even like, and they're saying with Florence, remember that Florence, it got up to a category 4, I think, but then it got downgraded all the way to 2, I think, before it hit landfall. And there's been a lot of talk about the fact that the categories, which are based entirely on sustained wind speed, can really be misleading because, like with Florence, you had this big, slow-moving, very heavy hurricane. The wind started to slow down, but it just dumped a ton of water on the region, on the Carolinas and on Virginia. And that does more damage, you know, that the amount of water that gets dropped. And this is the same thing, you know, just with the Amazon. Specifically, you have warming of the Atlantic and actually a little bit relative cooling of the Pacific. And that causes a dramatic increase in the amount of precipitation in the Amazon region. And so that more precipitation equals greater chance of flooding, higher flooding, more frequent flooding. And so that's what we're seeing. And it's you know, almost certainly going to get worse. So even if the number of storms don't increase, and even when the winds are not that big a deal, although they do tend to get more powerful too, the precipitation is really the thing that causes the problem. The other thing is that these slow moving hurricanes are worse because they obviously dump a lot more water in one location. You know, they don't bounce back out to sea or move on to another location. Mm. So the ones that get stalled or are slow to begin with, those are the ones that do the most damage because they get the worst flooding.
Mm.
All right, let's go back to number one. I think you guys misread this one, and I'll explain it to you in a second.
No. Don't worry. Right. What he says now doesn't mean anything.
A new study
oh my God,
study
we're such
finds
pessimists.
that it is more emotionally rewarding to be flattering rather than honest when giving critical feedback.
Not when giving critical feedback, not when receiving critical feedback.
So Bob was the only one who read this correctly.
It's rewarding to be flattering
when you are the one giving the feedback, right? Than to be honest. But ironically, this one is the fiction. So you guys all got it right by reading it wrong.
Bob got it wrong by reading it right.
Oh, man.
So if I was stupid and misinterpreted it, I might have won too.
Yeah, Bob, you got to be more stupid next time, man.
Yeah, Bob, get with our level.
You're not so stupid.
So Steve, you know, may have made an error in his idea that we got it wrong, but clearly we didn't get it wrong.
No, you did get it wrong. Because it's also completely flipped anyway, that the study shows actually that it's more rewarding to be honest than flattering or to be dishonest for social reasons. The study also showed what they found was that people greatly overestimated the negative impact or how uncomfortable it would be to be honest. And in fact, when they were honest, it was a much more positive experience than people thought it was going to be.
Mm. Oh, I see.
So, yeah, so this study supports the benefit socially of being honest and also says basically don't worry, that people worry a lot more about being honest. They overestimate the downside of being honest much more. Mm. So, in other words, people can handle, they can handle the truth more than you think they can. Yeah. Which, of course, was the headline, right? You know, people can
handle the truth.
But that's basically what it said. That actually people appreciate your honesty. You will feel better about being honest. The interaction's going to go a lot better than you think it will. And one thing that caught my attention about this, guys, Bob and Jay, we won't get into details, but Bob, Jay, and I had an experience recently where we had to have a very honest discussion with somebody we know. Yeah. And it went a lot better than we all thought it was going to go, right?
Yeah.
So it actually confirmed that little anecdote was in line with what the researchers were finding in this study, that you fear that like an honest confrontation is going to be really painful and uncomfortable. And it actually turned out to be everyone was happy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So be honest, I guess, is the bottom line recommendation of this. All of this means that Japanese scientists report the strongest controlled magnetic field ever recorded at 1,200 Tesla is science. And yes, strongest is very, very deliberate because scientists have created stronger magnetic fields with basically by using explosions. And
it's like a quick thing.
They were quick one-off,
right?
You know, and they were not controlled. This was indoors. And so this was a controlled indoor magnetic field, breaking the previous record of about 1,000 Tesla. So they increased from 1,000 to 1,200. And I think Jay, you mentioned, fusion reactors, and that was mentioned in the write-ups of this as well. That's one of the potential applications, because one of the approaches to controlled fusion is this is hot fusion, not cold fusion. Is you have to get those hydrogen or deuterium or whatever you're using, to get those atoms together. So you need to create a tremendous amount of heat and pressure. And the way to do that is with magnetic fields. So, of course, you have to create a very, very powerful, small, you know, tight magnetic field. The stronger the magnetic field and the more energy efficiently you can do that, the better the whole process works, the more likely it is to get cost-effective energy, net energy out of any kind of fusion process. So advances in the ability to create really powerful magnetic fields may one day lead to, you know, controlled fusion, which would absolutely change the world.
Oh, and God, levitating frogs. Yeah.
Can't wait.
Right. Yeah. Again, you know, like we're 50 years away and we've always been 50 years away. So
That's a lame comment. But it's true. Get with the times, dude. I mean, they're making lots. You know, sure, it's incremental, but there's a lot of incrementalness going on. And lots of some interesting new ideas. And I don't think it's valid anymore to say it's a bit 50 years away for 50 years kind of stuff. You know,
it's the same thing with artificial intelligence. Like we've been 50 years away for the last 50, 60 years. But I think what that really means is not that we're not making progress. That's the wrong way to interpret it. What it means is that the more we learn, the more we learn how difficult it is. And so our estimates increase along with the progress that we make, and they basically counteract each other.
Yeah, it's not like we're not learning anything along the way.
No, we're learning a ton. We're learning how difficult it is to freaking make artificial intelligence or cold or hot fusion or flying cars or
pretty
whatever.
Much any advanced science. I mean, everything, you know, there's a lot of things happening, a lot of very small incremental discoveries being made and an understanding of things. But again, like, where's the big battery breakthrough that we all thought we were going to, you know?
Well, that's different. See, that's a different issue. But batteries is that we are making slow, steady progress and we're making actual progress. You know what I mean? Batteries is not where there's a threshold where once we get past that threshold, suddenly the technology comes online, right? This is more that batteries are just steadily getting better every year. Just like, you know, solar technology, photovoltaic technology is getting slowly better every year. We're making tons of breakthroughs, and they're all, it's like curing cancer. Yeah, we're never going to quote unquote cure cancer, but we are making steady progress every year, increasing survival, et cetera. But this is more that we have this huge, you know, task that we're trying to complete that's very, very challenging. We estimate how long it's going to take based upon our current knowledge. As we gain more knowledge, we are advancing, but also learning that it's harder than we thought. And the estimate ends up staying around the same amount of time, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years away. But eventually we should get to the point where the estimate does start to shorten because I think the difference is between unknown unknowns and known unknowns, right? When we're still in the period where there are unknown unknowns, that's why your estimate is off. And as you learn what you don't know and then learn and then solve those problems, you're learning more about what you don't know. But at some point, you've mastered most of the unknown unknowns, and then you're left with mainly known unknowns. And then your estimates become more reliable, and you actually they'll start to shrink as you get closer and closer and closer to a tangible goal. But we're not there yet, is what I'm saying. We're not there yet with fusion, with controlled fusion. Although I do think, Bob, that we may be getting close.
It's not easy to say and predict. But from what I'm reading, I feel a lot better now than I did, you know, 10 years ago about it.
That's true.
I still think we could definitely see it in our lifetimes. Oh my God! It's so crazy that this isn't like at a level of like a Manhattan Project. And sure, there's a lot of money going into this. But imagine in an order of magnitude more. I don't know where these trillionaires or billionaires, you know, instead of going to the moon or flying around the moon, you know, I'd put that money into fusion or AI, just, you know, I mean, that's just like, come on, people. I'm just surprised that we're not seeing these huge investors more, you know, more Elon Musk's, you know, finding their passion and throwing crazy money at stuff that could really use some crazy money and have such.
Is it because it's not as sexy, not as instantly appealing?
I think that people don't want to like invest billions of dollars over 30 years and have nothing to show for it. I think like Elon Musk really thinks that we're going to get to Mars in his lifetime, and that whereas somebody who's 40 and has billions of dollars to invest, if you choose controlled fusion, you may not get to that goal in your lifetime. Mm-hmm. So that sort of scares people away. So we need to get to the point where we're close enough to achieving it that it will really start to attract investment and confidence, and then it'll maybe accelerate at that point. But I agree, though, because I think that's one of those technologies where the payoff is so ginormous. That's worth playing the lottery on that. You know, I would absolutely invest, you know, in tens, hundreds of billions of dollars in it. It'd be worth it. The payoff would be immense.
Right. Even if it takes a consortium of companies or even countries banding together and focusing together on that, the payoff, I mean, just from selling that technology throughout the world, you could like revitalize your entire country's economy because you have like the thing that everyone,
even if it's open source, even if it's open source, right? And nobody makes money off selling the patent or whatever.
Right.
Just the ability to produce massive amounts of non-polluting energy or minimally polluting. You know, there's always going to be some incidental pollution, but you know what I mean? You know, it will solve so many of our problems, and it will just put our civilization on a new trajectory that everyone would benefit from it so much that it is a worthwhile world endeavor, you know, and just make it be totally open source. Absolutely. And I don't know. I can't think of any downside to it, right? It's not like, could it be weaponized? I don't know. Like, what would, I don't think so. Like, what would be the, we already have bombs. It's not like, right. That was the easy part. You know what I mean? We already have fusion bombs. It's not like you're going to turn it into a weapon. We already have the weapon. We're trying to
go the other way.
Yeah, go the other way. Yeah. All right. Well, good job, guys. This, you know, it's hard to know how tricky these are going to be when I'm writing them, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
They are tricky.
Yeah.
Went through the back door. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
A great deal of intelligence can be invested in ignorance when the need for illusion is deep. That was written by Saul Bellow. Yes, he's only one of the distinguished 20th century authors. Canadian-American writer. He's been awarded the Pulitzer Prize, Nobel Prize for Literature, the Canadian National Medal of the Arts, and he's the only writer to win the National Book Award for Fiction 3 times.
Wow.
Quite distinguished in his life. Born in 1915, he died in 2005. I had not read any of his books, though. I haven't. I probably should read one at some point. Some of our listeners may know some of his books. The Adventures of Augie March, Henderson the Rain King, Mr. Samier's Planet, Seize the Day, Humboldt's Gift, and Ravenstein.
The day is mine.
Glad you said that, Jay.
Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Doc.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.